elevations where the dimensions are too high, less than 10 perhaps, when there's a lot of symmetry. So what I aim to do is, I'm going to start at what I hope is a quite an elementary level. I mean, I see a lot of young faces here, I hope there's a lot of postgrads here. I hope I don't start too low, but in my experience, most people don't really object to telling things they already know. The first half hour or so is going to be very elementary for people who already know a bit of stuff, but hopefully it'll be as strong as perhaps some people are not so familiar with it. And my aim is, at the end of the time, hopefully within probably less than 2 hours that have been allocated, I'll show you how to calculate the beam intensity. I'm going to do an example, particularly with Schwarzschild de Sitter, and just calculate beam intensity using differential forms, and hopefully show you that it's much more simple than using coordinates. So there's nothing new in what I'm saying. It's all standard formulation. But I don't know if a lot of it is actually. I've never actually seen a relativity textbook that shows you how to do the calculations. Lots of modern textbooks will show you the formulation of differential forms, but they never actually use them for anything. and I think they are useful. So what I'm aiming at is to calculate the beam tensor. And then Lee Smalling has kindly offered to carry on using, and you'll show you how to use this formulation in Archicus formulation of general relativity, the Blavatsky formulation of general relativity, which differential forms are really the best arena for describing Archicus formulation. Okay, so the starting point is we know that for some reason or other, almost all of physics is described using fields, tensor fields of some kind. So almost everything can be written in terms of tensor fields of some kind or another. So a generic tensor field, W, this is a tensor, often called a tensor of type PQ. So mu and U are coordinates, we could be working in any dimension at the moment. So if you give Q conjugated indices and P covariant indices, and you want to distinguish them. And when you first come across differential geometry, you're always told that you can't differentiate tensors in general without introducing new structure. You need to have, in order to differentiate a tensor, you need to be able to compare the physical field at two different points in a curved space in general. And in order to do that, you need some rule like parallel transport in order to be able to compare them. So you need to introduce a connection to differentiate the general tensor field. And if you differentiate this thing, then I'll use notation that I assume is familiar with everyone. Covariant derivative in the quadrant direction lambda is a tensor of type plus 1. That's what covariant differentiation does. But there's a special class of tensors for which you don't need a connection. So it's very easy to see that, in particular if you take, for example, just a tensor with one index on it. So under a coordinate transformation, if you change the coordinate basis, so you know that this is how you expect the coordinates for the tensor to change. So if you differentiate this, the components, so then you can use the chain rule. Thank you. definition of flush town. I don't need to change anything. Make like this. Then change it and cross it down. And you're always, and of course, the reason you need to introduce a one, you see mathematically why you need to introduce a connection, is that this term here is stopping the thing from transforming like a tensor. But the point is that if you anti-symmetrize on these two indices, you find the new thing. That's the same thing as anti-symmetrizing those two, and then this disappears. Stand back and go for Corinthians.
Nope, you know that. You see my under. You had the in the first term.
Hey, that's a lot of this. Okay. So, and in fact, in general, if you take tensors of type P0, which are completely anti symmetric, so, and they let me include a basis. So if this tensor is completely anti-symmetric in all those indices, I'll introduce a basis here where this wedge means it's the anti-symmetric product of all these basis elements. So in particular, px mu, px mu is minus px mu, px mu, px mu. Then we can differentiate this without using a connection. And the derivative is just something like this. And because of the anti-symmetric product, with this upside down B is called the wedge product, and this is essentially the anti-symmetric part of a general tensor product. Because this thing is completely anti-symmetric in all the indices here, then this derivative here is completely anti-symmetrized. And this is a covariant. This is a tensor. It's a covariant object because under quantum transformations, all of these things here will disappear. So alpha here is called a p-form. And this d comes under the name of XD derivative. Because of the anti-symmetric nature of this derivative, you always have t squared as 0. So examples.
So you lose the anti-symmetrization.
I mean,
the mu's are no longer anti-symmetric.
Well, they are because of this wedge here. Oh, implicit in here.
So your anti-symmetrization, when you put brackets, there's also a numerical factor that goes on. You mean all the permutation weighted? Or is it just all the permutations?
This is all permutations, and the 1 over p factorial is over 1. Okay, I mean, I read an example explicitly. So examples. Familiar with are obviously if p is 0, then it's just a scalar. If p is 1, you have a 1 form, example of physics is a connection one for potential for a gauge field. And if P is 2, then the one gauge field, the connection is just the extra position gauge. So to answer your question about the weighting there, F, the two form itself, is 1/2 the components of the basis, which is half of so this this combination here is what I would call D mu in square box. Okay. So this P factorial here is a convention which takes account of the weight of the disintegration of the brackets. Can I ask how familiar is this to people? Has everyone seen all this stuff before, or is this completely new to some people? Is there anyone for whom this is completely new? Okay, you've all seen it before. You haven't come across this way of writing language?
I'm familiar. I've seen it before, but I can see it's coming.
That's okay. Cool. If you want to ask anything, please. Okay, so the message to take from this is that there's a special class of tensors which you can differentiate in a particular way without using a connection. The exterior derivative is an extremely primitive structure. It doesn't require a connection, it doesn't require a metric. It's just something that's intrinsic to the property of your space that you're working on. It requires a differential structure again. When you demand that things are differentiable, but you don't need a connection. So it's really a very primitive object. It's interesting that a lot of physical fields, like the Maxwell field, can be written in terms of exterior derivatives. But you can't write any dynamics down with just an exterior derivative. You need more information to write any dynamics down in these fields.
So I have a question. Mm-hmm. So you can differentiate this without a connection. Intuitively, I always think of the connection as being something that arises because you're looking at a space which is about two different points, right? And moving from one point to another, you're looking at comparison between them. But I don't have an intuitive feel for why that doesn't apply in some cases. Right? Except if the space is flat.
If you try to take the commutator, so you say you have two different derivatives with two different connections. Mm-hmm. And you differentiate your P form by using one and the other, and you take the difference, you'll see that because every connection is symmetric in its indices, then it's just an advantage.
Well, there's a proviso there. That's only true if there's no torsion.
But I mean, most theories are.
Well, what I'm saying is, an important message to take away from this for electromagnetism. Components of an electromagnetic field tensor are this, independent of any connection, independent of the existence of torsion. But you need no structure beyond the statement that things are differentiable in order to be able to write down a Maxwell stress tensor. Sometimes you'll see people write equations like this. I have seen this. Well, you should really use a covariant derivative to define differentiation. But then, if the connection is symmetric and there's no torsion, you need a recall. But they're not equal if there's torsion. So if you have torsion, this is the one to use. No one in the right mind would use that. So that answers one question. The other question was. Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that at a really intuitive level. I mean, it's a mathematical observation that when you anti-symmetrize, all of these inhomogeneous terms disappear. So the same, because if they're purely anti-symmetric tensors, it's quite possible to differentiate using two points that are quite close to each other. But I mean, I shouldn't even use the word close, because I have an integer dimension. So you don't even know what close means. It's no meaning.
I think there's another way of looking at it to see why the exterior derivative doesn't require a metric. If you think of the Stokes theorem, okay, the Stokes theorem shows you that the exterior derivative is the dual to the boundary operator. It's you from a manifold to its boundary. And that's totally independent of the metric.
Yes, that requires more global information. And everything I've said so far is completely wrong. Yeah, you can integrate differential forms from the manifold over a manifold. And anything that's, in a d-dimensional manifold, you can integrate a d-form in a covariant way. And if your d-form is the exterior derivative of a d-1 form, then that's just a boundary term. But everything, at the moment I've said nothing about integration, everything at the moment is completely wrong. I can't give a impression. Okay. I'm going to introduce another bit of notation which I'm going to need. It won't be immediately obvious why it's necessary, but I'm going to introduce it. I've defined here differential forms and exterior derivatives. So another notion which is useful. Called interior derivative. It has nothing to do with calculus. And if we have a vector field, which I write, vector fields involve derivatives, then the components VU, we know that when you have a vector field VU and a one form alpha, then we know that we can always contract the components of a vector with the components of a one form in a scalar. I stress, I have still not introduced a metric. Right? I'm not saying there's any relation between V and alpha, just independent objects. Then I would write this, it's a fairly standard notation. There's different ways of writing it. Another common way of writing this would be to use Brown-Kett-type notation. That would be alpha B. So I'm going to introduce this notation. I being interior derivative. Called interior derivative, although it doesn't involve differentiation in any way. You can generalize this to a more general P form. So this alpha here is a one form. And for a P form, I'm going to define the interior derivative to break it up into these components. I'll sum from -1 to P. -1 to power I, so it's an alternating sum. And I contract the components of the vector V with each index and alpha alternatively, depending, and there's a sign here depending on which position the index nu goes to. And this is a P-1 form. So this, given a vector field, this interior derivative must be formed 50 minus 1 forms. Because alpha is completely anti-symmetric, this is actually just the same thing. It's over p minus 1 factorial. I mean, I can always use the anti-symmetry to bring this index to the front. And this minus sign here will always be excited. It kind of charged with, well, I guess I should make that plus 1. Because I want the plus sign being used in the first place. So I can always bring mu through, because this thing is completely anti-symmetric in all synthesis, I can bring my index mu through to the front. And there's p terms here, so this p factorial becomes p minus 1.
So that should be dx mu to the I plus
1. Yeah, this is I plus 1, yes. I'm missing the dx mu I term. So there's a way of contracting. So an interior derivative, given a vector field, you can use the interior derivative to map p forms down to p minus 1 forms. It's completely unobvious why that's a useful thing to do at the moment. But this is a convenient place to introduce it. And we'll see later why it's not useful. Okay, so yeah. So.
Can I ask a double advocate question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then now I'll pretend that I don't know and that I've never heard of this, and if I'd never heard of these things before and you showed me the exterior derivative, I would see a natural map from p forms to p plus 1 forms that didn't require really any structure.
Yes.
Whereas here we have a map from p forms to p minus 1 forms that requires that you specify a vector field.
Mm-hmm.
So if I didn't know what you were going to use this for earlier, I might say, why isn't there some notion of a map from p forms to p minus 1 forms that doesn't require some additional structure, like a vector field?
First instinct is to say that I suppose in a kind of sense, you can reduce the degree of a form by integration over some matrix. That would be, I mean, if what you're asking for is the inverse of the exterior derivative, then the nearest thing is an inverse of the exterior derivative integration. So I mean, you could maybe, if you chose a one-dimensional submanifold, then you could just try integrating a form over that manifold. You're still choosing something.
Yeah, and it's really choosing the same kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, that, you could think the manifold as being the exponential of the vector field or something.
Are you also going to talk about the codedivision? Maybe that's what you have in mind.
But see, the codedivision requires a metric.
Yeah, but it's
so that doesn't require an extra structure. So it doesn't answer the question, I don't think. Because you need to introduce a metric to find the codedivision. Okay, so I guess the answer is that the opposite of differentiation is integration, and this is kind of an implicit version of integration. That's one way to answer the question. Okay, so far I've assiduously avoided introducing metric. So there's not really much structure to what I've been saying. Although, as I'm sure a lot of you already know, differential forms do carry a lot of information about global topology. But they don't, in themselves, they will not give you any real physics. In order to discuss dynamics, you do need to introduce a metric. So, as you all know, if you want to discuss distances on a curved space, then the relevant concept is the metric, which in a coordinate basis is usually written like this. And my convention here is that if there's no wedge between these things, then obviously it's not a wedge problem. Right? The wedge here implies an anti-symmetrization. But here, because I mean, G mu nu here is a symmetric tensor, so it's only the symmetric combination that comes in. A mathematician, I suppose, would probably put an extra circle around it there and say there's a symmetric tensor form or something like that. Let's keep rotation to a minimum. If there's no wedge, then there's no particular symmetry in the plot.
No, in this case, only the symmetry pops up on the G is
symmetric. So G is your metric. So dx mu here is a coordinate basis for one force. But another basis, it's often very useful to use not a coordinate basis, but an orthonormal basis. So I'm going to take linear combinations of these things in d dimensions of the d of them. So mu here is an index which might run from 1 to d, or actually, if I'm doing Lorentzian signature, I might prefer to take from 0 to d minus 1, but for d's number of dimensions. It's a coordinate index. These a's here are also, they take the same, have the same range as mu. So 0 to d here would be a useful convention for your Euclidean signature. And 0 up to d minus 1 would be more useful for Lorentzian. Depends on the signature dimension. And the A's take the same range, because if you want a complete basis for your vectors and your one forms, then obviously you want to deal with these things. So this mu here coordinate index, this A here is orthonormal. So all of these, so here we have D one forms, each of which has length one. So in other words, if we plug two of these things into the metric and evaluate the number, then I'll write it as B. So the eta's in Euclidean signatures, this would just be delta function. This would just be going for delta. But in Lorentzian signature, one of these could be minus one and the rest would be plus one. So the eta just to be completely pedantic about it. In Euclidean signature, these are just usually called delta, but in Lorentzian signature, as the conventions, and one of them would be the opposite sign to the other. So I'll choose a convention where the timeline effect is minus one. And the space like ones, and not possible. In the literature, you'll very often see people refer to eta as a sort of metric. And that's a phrase I do not like. Eta is a metric on a curved space in general. It's just written on an orthonormal basis. It's not a flat metric. You know, I'm not saying that this metric is flat. We have a curved metric. But any metric in any curved space will have components like this on an orthonormal basis, just by definition. It doesn't mean the metric is flat. But you will often see people refer to this as a flat metric. So in terms of these, this is a D by D. You can think of these little E's here as being the components of a D by D matrix. So another way of writing this, so this g mu mu that is upstairs, of course, is the inverse of this g mu mu with the inverse downstairs. So one can equally well say that if you take the inverse for the four matrix, that's essentially, I'm just rearranging this equation here. Take this equation here, think of it as an equation from d to g, d to g matrix equation, and multiply the right by the inverse of g. Oh, right. Quite an but this equation follows from there. One other way is I'm just rewriting the same equation in different ways here. And we could also use the inverse matrix minus one. So this is the inverse folder before we introduce that one. This matrix here is often called a literature of C phrases. In four dimensions, these are called vier binds. From the vier is the German for four, binds is the German for leg. It means four legs. In German. In more than four dimensions, it's often called a wheel bind, which means many legs. So in four dimensions, the EA consists of four off-round vectors. So there's a frame which can move around. So it may be pointing in different directions and move around the space. But at each point, you have a frame which spans the tangent space.
Does it also hold the
Yeah, tetrad is also used as well, instead of in four dimensions. Okay. So a very simple example. Would be the round matrix of a sphere. S2, the invariant line element you do it like this, so you have your vector components in a coordinate basis of the usual one you expect for two-dimensional sphere. But we could, if we define one form E1, which is R d theta, and the second one E2, which is R tangent d phi, then we see that we can write E and U, in this case a 2x2 matrix, is essentially the square root of the matrix, if you like. That's a particularly trivial example. Makes the concepts a little more concrete. Okay. The dual basis, we can define a dual basis. Now that we've got a metric, we can map vectors to one forms. So we have any vector we can associate that with a one form. So I'll define vectors, which are called capital E, and put an arrow above it to indicate this is actually this is meant to be a vector. By taking the inverse matrix, I'm using this notation to make it absolutely explicit. I hope to avoid confusion. I'll always put a minus one on the inverse. You'll find here. You can tell from the indices, and you can see if you've got a coordinate index upstairs here and the coordinate index is downstairs here. So you can actually tell from the position of the indices what I'm talking about, the matrix index. So this is a redundant notation. However, later on, I'm going to start arbitrarily raising and lowering the orthonormal indices. Which, in case it causes confusion, I'm using a redundant notation here for our vectors to indicate. sorry, in particular. But I've given two examples here. And another word of warning I should give you is in this two-by-two example, because it is particularly simple form of line element, particularly symmetric form of line element, this turns out to be a symmetric matrix indeed diagonal. But the index labeling the rows is an orthogonal index, the index labeling the columns is a coordinate index. So that should immediately warn you that in general these things don't even have to be diagonal. There are no particular symmetry properties in general. Okay, so the inverse, I can define in d dimensions, I'll define d vector fields, these capital D's, which are obtained by contracting the coordinate vectors in the log of partial derivatives with the inverse wave vectors. And now, a piece of notation that I've used is the interior derivative with respect to an orthonormal coordinate vector. If I contract an orthonormal one form EB to an orthonormal vector capital EA, I just get delta EB, delta AB, zero. And this is always plus one, regardless of the signature. By definition, just because this thing here is by definition the inverse matrix. The way I constructed the interior derivative, just make it explicit. A piece of notation that I should have mentioned earlier. I should have put it on the right hand board there. I've only written down a basis for one forms there, the CVAs. An off normal basis for P forms. Of these things, and then you can write any key form in the combination of these things. This appears so frequently that I'll abbreviate it. So I can keep on writing all the way across. So with that notation, the contraction of an orthonormal vector EA, capital EA, with a two form. Little AB, is delta AB. So you're contracting a two form, so I should get a one form. When the orthonormal vector A hits the orthonormal one form EB, I get a delta AB. But I can also pull the A through the first orthonormal one form. And remember, when you pull it through, you pick up a minus sign. So when you contract the two form, with an orthonormal vector EA, you get delta AB with EC, but then you can also get a delta AC, but because of the anti-symmetry properties of the interior derivative, there's minus sign there. By construction, these are all completely covariant expressions. If I put a plus sign there, it wouldn't be covariant. You need this minus sign for the contraction. So that's orthonormal vectors. I should stress, and I've said that these EAs are, by definition, they're chosen to be an orthonormal basis at any point. But of course, you can always rotate by an orthonormal transformation and get another set, another completely valid basis set. So, you can rotate. I put this in quotes because it's only a notation because your signature, your Lorentzian signature, is a Lorentz transformation. So by use of abusive language, whenever I say rotate, you should interpret that as being a Lorentz transformation in the Lorentz signature. And I will now, I haven't made it absolutely explicit here, but I hope it's clear. These things all depend on the position of the space. So use label the points in space by a coordinate text. At any given point, I can rotate my orthonormal basis and a new orthonormal basis, and I can even do a different rotation at every point. There's no need to, it doesn't have to do a global rotation, it can be a local rotation. So, if I'm the A prime B here, these are elements of either SOD in Euclidean space, D-dimensional Euclidean space, or SOD minus 1, comma 1 in D-dimensional Lorentzian signature. So I should say Euclidean space and Euclidean metric. That's cut in general. So in Euclidean signature, these lines A, D's are just maybe they really are rotation matrices. But in Lorentzian signature, there's Lorentzian signatures. And then, of course, the dual basis has to go the opposite way. Right, so if it's a one-form basis rotated with lambda, then the vector basis has to be taken from the minus one. That's an angle. Then the interior derivative of capital E A prime is B prime, is still just a density. Right, so here I've introduced the concept of local tangent space rotations. We can do a different rotation at every point, and everything still stands. The next thing, of course, we need for differential forms, you still have to introduce a connection. If you want to differentiate things that are not actually forms, then you still have to introduce a connection. Well, I'll assume you're familiar with the way it's done in coordinates. You introduce this notion of something called parallel transport. It's a rule for transporting vectors around space. If you have any curve between two points, you can parallel transport a vector along that curve from the first point to the second point. And get from any vector in the tangent space to the first point, you can get a vector in the tangent space to the second point. The vector you get, of course, depends not only on the points, but also on the curve. In general relativity, and very often in other areas of differential geometry, it's usual to assume that parallel transport preserves limits. So when you move your vectors around, you want lengths to be conserved. A fancy mathematician would say that the connections are measure compatible. In formulae, the way most people learn this is the Fourier derivative of the rotic by a semicolon. So that's the Fourier derivative of the combination of sines, right? And it's minus statement that Lenz has set up is equivalent.
the statement that if you pile up transport, the metric components are you make them change.
Is that all M then?
No.
Yes.
It's not always lengths, right? It's lengths and angles.
Yes, this equation deals with terms all in a product. So, okay. Well, there's an analog of this equation with orthonormal one forms. Define covariant derivative of our variables. It's going to be okay. Partial derivative. Yeah, we've got a coordinate index down here. So I'll need the connection coefficients and the coordinates. That's not enough. There's also an orthonormal index. So I need a connection component for that. So write that. And the statement that it's connection direction compatible is that this should be zero. Now we know what these are, this is often called the Lefty beta connection. You can calculate these from this equation here in a way that I'm sure people can worry. If not, here are components. This thing here is often called the spin connection. So the risk of being called a pedantic conduction, I would say that these appellations, Lefty beta and spin, are irrelevant. This is the same connection. It's just, this is written in a coordinate basis and this is written in an orthonormal basis. It's the same connection. It has nothing to do with spin. It's just an orthonormal basis. The reason it's called a spin connection, I think, is that if you want to write down the Dirac equation, this is the only one you can use. It's really messy to write the Dirac equation in terms of coordinate connection. If you write the Dirac equation, then the connection, the only sensible way of doing it is to write the connection on an orthonormal basis. So it's the orthonormal basis connection that usually appears in the Dirac equation. For that reason, people call it a spin connection. There's nothing intrinsic to doing this. It's the same object as this. It's just written on an orthonormal basis instead of a coordinate basis. And of course, the connection is not a tensor. So the relation between them is not the usual tensorial relation. But if we rearrange this equation,
I heard someone call it the spider.
On my side of the Atlantic, the pronunciation is spinner connection, which is just the same thing as a spin connection. Yes. Okay. Well, if we multiply this equation here by the inverse matrix, we can isolate this object. So you just multiply on the right by the inverse of this thing. And then you get an e to the minus 1 in here. And I guess I'll need a minus sign here. This is the relation between the connection and the orthonormal basis and the connection and the coordinate basis. The first part here is the way you would expect a tensor to transform. You convert this coordinate index u into an orthonormal index v just by multiplying by e to the minus 1. And you convert this coordinate index lambda into an orthonormal index a just by multiplying by e. But there's an inhomogeneous town, of course, because it's not a person. It's the same connection, just written two different places.
So, under what condition could you just give out the Lemsin's connection?
Under what condition would you leave behind it? It can't be left out in. Okay, I suppose I'm just about to answer that question. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take this equation and I'm going to write it. I'm going to take the antisymmetric part of it. We'll take this equation here. I'll take the antisymmetric part of it and write it in two form. Now, you would think you're losing information in doing that. Because you would think the symmetric part here will get information away. But actually, you don't. So let me antisymmetrize this. And then I'll define two form which of course is going to be zero because it's a vanishing two form. Now this thing, omega AB, is a bunch of one forms with two orthonormal indices on them. Called the connection one forms. This object here. I define it's a bunch of two forms that are called capital T, and it's a Christoffel symbol anti-symmetrized, well, not Christoffel symbol, excuse me, whatever you connection. It's a connection symbol anti-symmetrized in these cases. So usually in general relativity, you assume the connection symbols are symmetric. This is what we're talking. So, bottom line is, I shouldn't even use it there. I want that symbol capital D for something else. Really, exactly. I'm sorry.
I have a question. Like here, the torsion equals zero is leads to B being, or being the omega being metric compatible. Right?
Even if it's non-zero, it's still metric compatible.
It's still metric compatible.
Torsion doesn't destroy. This is the statement of metric compatibility. Whether or not the torsion is zero, this is always true.
But this is the torsion with the brackets. It's the torsion zero condition.
And the torsion zero condition.
Here you wrote it. And you added the brackets.
That's the torsion zero condition.
Yes, but in terms of E, DE, the two form DE is called torsion, right?
I wouldn't call it torsion in my language. Maybe
I guess that's what's confusing you because often that's called the torsion.
The
two form.
Well, this two form. Yes. Call that torsion.
Which is not what you wrote over there,
no.
which is the same what you wrote. You have, you see that two form over there with the square bracket.
This one.
Yeah,
that's zero by definition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not torsion.
It's not the torsion. No, I'm
okay,
saying. What I'm saying is that mesh compatibility demands that the full covariant derivative of the beer bounds should vanish. That's including the orthonormal index and the informant index. That's mesh compatibility. Then when you take the anti-symmetric part of this to construct a vanishing two-form, the vanishing two-form tells you this must be true. Everything is still mesh compatible. But the torsion is an additional geometric structure that you're putting in there on the manifold over and above the metric.
Metric compatibility just is the same as the same thing you talked about the parallel.
Yeah, it's this equation written for the view bands. It's a view band version of this.
I just want to make sure that.
Wait, the second line here.
This
way, do we agree that that's just the equation t equals zero for the t that you define on the right?
No. This equation here is not telling you torsion is zero.
Okay.
The middle term here is a torsion. That doesn't have to vanish.
But the t that, but does it mean t equals zero according to the definition of t over there?
Okay. And from now on, I'm going to put t equals zero. never consider torsion.
The first equation doesn't actually give you the expression that people usually write down for the Levinsky BT connection. It's that plus the assumption.
So maybe I did. I think at one point I called this Levinsky BT and then created myself. This capital gamma here does not have to be symmetric. Break it up into the symmetric part and the symmetric part. The symmetric part is Levinsky BT. The argument part is torsion. Is that done? You know, I've obviously said something that's caused confusion. And the statement that the metric is, that your connection is metric compatible is the statement.
I just take it for granted that first equation ends up giving me something like the expression I usually write down, but it's not just that, it's that plus another assumption.
Yeah, maybe it's this simple capital D that's confusing you.
That's just the definition, right? I mean, this is just all this definition is for you.
I would call this capital D the total covariant derivative. You have to make sure that everything is covariant both with respect to the orthonormal index and with respect to the covariant index.
I think the thing is that the torsion, right, is anti-symmetric. So when you derive by the metric, the torsion doesn't play a part in the variant derivative of the metric.
You cannot get torsion from this equation here.
And so
that's the confusion. And the coordinate, these two equations are not absolutely equivalent. There's something more information in it than one.
You have to take that equation and do like cyclic permutations or something and then collect the terms to get an expression for gamma, and then you lose the piece of the torsion.
Well, if you take the symmetric part of this equation, then you get the usual way to use that. I mean, when I first wrote this equation down, I wrote it for R between you and you. I wrote it later on in a pre-square bracket.
I think this also could
It's true for all you and you, both the symmetric and the anti-symmetric. But you can actually deduce this. What's sort of kind of intuitive is you only need the anti-symmetric part. You can actually deduce the symmetric part from the anti-symmetric part.
So where's T defined over there?
It's the middle term. Just the middle term.
It's this bracket.
Oh, that's what you call it.
Oh, that's the definition of T.
Because sometimes I saw the definition of T equal.
These guys are the same ones, yeah.
Because sometimes I saw the definition T equal B. That's.
I did actually. At one stage, I wrote this
And then how do we scrub that out? Because I want to use application later for something else. I think the confusion is probably in the notation capital B here. I probably shouldn't use that. Maybe I should have called this. Del total or something. Total. Because I am going to use the single capital B for something else, for precisely what you would expect to do later on. And it's not the same thing as this.
And also, this is a bit of an academic point since everyone did make torsion zero.
Yeah. Maybe I
should
just never have mentioned torsion. So it's so natural to discuss torsion within the Cartan framework. I couldn't help mentioning it because it just comes out so simply. But from now on, I'm going to put torsion zero. Okay. So with zero torsion, we have this equation, which is the first Cartan structure equation, intuitive.
The what?
I think it's called the first Cartan structure equation, or the first structure equation of Cartan. I'd like to say a little bit about rotations, or Lorentz transformations. If we choose a different orthonormal basis, then this equation holds true in any orthonormal basis, so I can choose a different orthonormal basis. Of course, this is lambda, of course, can depend on position. The extra derivative of the A prime here, I pick up the derivative of lambda. And so this whole thing is going to be zero. So we get D lambda A prime. Now, DEB, I can replace that with minus. Using this equation on the original basis. Now, if I multiply through by the inverse of this lambda, so multiply through by the inverse of this, equals a lambda with minus 1, let's see, so B
thank you.
time. So it's not so clear.
Is there no DM of the spin dimensions? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm taking this equation here. I'm using this, and I've still got this as A times B type, so this this D here is coming from that. So D on this plus B on this. And this is just the same as that. Gone too far. I shouldn't have viewed this equation here. I should just have left that plus. That's what I'm going to do. Because then,
so you sort of Lorentz transform it and then inverse Lorentz transform it?
Yeah, I'm probably doing it in a cack-handed way. I want to get the relation between the spin connection, the connection is prime frame, the connection on prime frame. In a very efficient way.
Can you probably just write down the hands? For us.
Sure. Although I should have done. I started now, so I remove this by multiplying by the inverse.
You're still missing the lambda inverse on the last term.
Yeah, I'm missing those here. So you can work with the detail, what you can find is the omega. Suppressing all the indices. So the prime on here means this is all again the prime frame. And lambda remember is a location, position dependent location. So omega here these orthonormal indices are indicating that omega is actually in the real algebra of the rotation. And this is exactly the same as the way that diagonals connection transforms. Locked into an element of the group. As long as it's probably bad notation, because it's probably half to tell the difference between my ranges and my lines of my legs and then so I can probably use a different notation for the elements of the landscape. So this is actually the indices here are indicating that this is the algebra for SOT, or SOT minus 1, comma 1. The geometrical construction here is exactly the same as the other ones. We have a connection which lies in the lead group of some gauge group, maybe this independent position. It's a one form. It transforms exactly the same way as any Jan-Mills connection would transform. The only subtlety is that in Lorentzian signature, the group is non-compact. But apart from that, it's exactly analogous to the Jan-Mills connection. If we have the rotation generators, capital L for the generators, preserving capital lambda for the group elements, then the order of recognition is very easy for the general case. This is the rotation algebra of the Lorentz algebra. And this omega here is just the connection one form is contracted with the generator of the Lorentz rotation. These capital L's are matrices, of course, so I'm missing off matrix in things to see. And I should also mention that there's a subtlety Lorentzian signature, and the orthonormal indices are raised and lowered in such a way as to change the sign of the time-like components. And the minus signs that crop up all over the place in Lorentzian signature. So I'm defining on the AP. I raise the index theta, which of course makes no difference for an Euclidean signature, because it is just a cosmic delta. But in the next thing, you're going to change the signs on the components. So, omega is an SOT correction. Exactly the same as the Poisson's. There's absolutely no difference from the lemma that I'm presenting here. Of course, the dynamics are different. I mean, once you write an action, the reaction is different, the dynamics are different. But if you allow me to call this kinematics, then the kinematics of general relativity are identical. They are mostly truly exactly the same structure.
You have more than just the spin connection, you also have the touch.
The level of connection. There's no analog of this in Jan-Mills. There's no analog of that equation in Jan-Mills. But once you've got the connection in general is exactly the same as the connection in Jan-Mills. I never want to derive an equation, a very simple equation, allows you actually to derive the connection from a given measure. So we start off a zero torsion condition. I'll contract that with an orthonormal vector. So that's up over two forms, so I'm going to write a one-form equation. The contraction, first of all, it hits the omega, so I get IC omega. This is just a number, so I don't need to put away what's omega is a one-form remember, so contracting it to the one-form is just a bunch of numbers. But the contraction can also pull through the omega. Omega is a one-form, so pick the minus. And then I get IC and EB, but that's just IC getting EB is just delta CB, so that's just the one mix. And if I contract the second term, ID here, all you can do is hit the EB and give a delta BG, so that B becomes a B. Right, now what I'm going to do is going to take linear combinations of these. But what I'm doing here is exactly analogous to the way you calculate the limit of the connection using the equation that says the covariant energy measure is zero. It's exactly the same methodology. Right. So, if I look at this last equation here, I'll hit it with everything in here is just a number. They're all zero forms. So I'll fill around the indices a bit. So I lower this A and call it a C. I call this D an A and I call this C a B. So this D is becoming A, this C is becoming B, and I've lowered the A in front of C. And then last, I lower the A and call it a C, I turn the C into a B, and this ID becomes an A. Let me call it equation 1. So all I've done is rewrite this equation here.
Where does the EC come
from? Oh, multiplying by EC. Oh. I'm multiplying this equation by EC and then shuffling the answers. And it's trivial, totally trivial information. But if I try and now, if we take this equation here, I lower the A and turn the C into a B. Do that, I better change the dummy estimation version there. So I lower this A and turn the C into the B. And then I'll write the same thing with A and B switch around. I hope I've chosen the indices judicially so that I can now take linear combinations of these things. I get the connection itself purely in terms of dA. So let's see, if I add 1 to 2, here I've got an ID omega AC. Here's an ID on the CA. Oh, there's one other piece of information I need to give you, which I haven't told you yet. And I should have said it here. Because this is SOD,
they're anti-symmetric. That's even true for the lens signature. When you use a theta to read the lower indices, this is always true. So this is always anti-symmetric, even Lorentz signature, as long as both indices are upstairs. That's an important distinction. Because then, if I add 1 and 2, here I have ID on the AC, here I have ID on the CA. And this EC, this is just a number, so it doesn't matter whether this EC is in the right hand side. So if I add these two things, they'll cancel. And if I subtract that equation, yeah. Here we have IA on the BC. Don't forget about this EC for a moment, because this one is just a number. IA on the BC here, minus IA on the CB. So this is plus IA on the BC. That is subtractive. He's going. So what I get is that BC is the next method of expression that allows you to calculate the connection coefficients on an off normal basis. Once you know the normal forms. So, trivial example. Or maybe. Well, I guess I should show. I'll define what I call covariant exterior dual diffusion. The one on the inner one forms, and this is exterior. This is exactly analogous to the covariant derivative in Yang-Wilson. Exactly the same thing. This connection is an SOT, or SOT minus 1, comma 1 connection. And the curvature use capital R for curvature for all the reasons. The commutator. This is Cartan's second trust equation. Remember, right, break this into components. This is a two form, so it's fine to the basis of two forms, and of course, in these things, the other components are leading tensor, in an off normal basis. think this was the source of confusion when I was talking about proportion. List alpha and vj is not the same as what we had before. I should use a different symbol from the topical coordinate. So in terms of this, I'm talking about the table, which I think is also called a confusion. This capital is not the same as the total coordinate.
Yeah, but with that D, now I can say that T is
D. This is now saying T is U. For the end of it, we can function as that. So this is Cartan's first structure equation. This is Cartan's.
When you work with coordinate unisons, you can always go locally
referring. Once you're working with a level of tensors rather than connections, you can immediately jump into the coordinates.
But I can always work in a locally referring where the gammas are zero. Can I always go to a framework? Your
omega
is zero, and your curvature is just
D on the. You can always go to a frame where the omega can vanish another point, but then the derivatives will not be generated.
Sure.
Checking on your.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So let me summarize, and then I'll go and do a couple of examples. We have a metric. We should be either on a coordinate basis or an orthogonal basis. And I put a dot here, this is not wedge particle. We have the first Cartan, that's an equation, I assume the torsion. And as an aside, although this is technically an extremely useful equation, and it does nothing for you conceptually. But I'll just remind you. In terms of the machine. And then a couple of different forms. Right. That summarizes everything I've said in the last bit. But really only focusing on the a couple of trivial examples. First one, you can show the one. Yeah, the second one. Let's take a two-dimensional sphere. It's a constant radius. Then, we can choose an orthogonal basis, I mentioned before. It's not unique, you can always locate it, only by either local S or two locations. Work out the x and derivatives. Well, r is a constant, I'm assuming r is a constant. So the x and derivatives is just d squared theta, that's 0. D of d2. And you differentiate sine theta from cos theta. I can rewrite that in an orthogonal basis because it was E12 is just the volume element. So this is Rock out of connection, one forms, only one. This feels a tremendous labor saving of what we usually order for. If you did this in coordinates, you'd have to work out how many six Christoffel forms. Only one in this formulation. It's immensely more efficient in more dimensions. Well, if you use this formula here, if d equals 1 and b equals 2, so I'm summing over c here, of course, so we're doing a contraction here with 1 and a contraction with 2. So c is equal to 1 gives no contribution because d e minus 0. So the only thing we have is e 2. Then I have minus I1 e2, and then there's a plus I2 e1, but of course that's 0. Now here I have dE2 in an orthonormal basis. So if I contract, the fact that this index is downstairs doesn't matter because of the Euclidean signature. So I can use more without changing anything. So I take I1, I2. So let's contract with 2 first. To contract with 2, I have to pull it through the E1. So I get a minus E1, and then you contract with the 1, and you just get minus 1. So what I'm using here, maybe I should here. The second term here is I contract this with I1. When I contract with I1, remember the formula I wrote down earlier. I contract this with I1, I'm just going to get E2. These reinforce the cancel one. Yeah, I just got theta and E2. So I'm using the fact here that I2 and E12 is minus E1. So I2 followed by I1, E12, which is X1. And I1 and E12, which is plus E2. If I that's what I've done. And E2, in order to calculate the Riemann tensor, this is the there, of course, we only one component. We just have to take extra root with this. And the most convenient thing to do then is to rewrite this in terms of a coordinate basis of the moment. So this is minus some theta. The cosine theta. The sine theta over r, one over r sine theta in here just cancels. Tensor pops out. I get an orthonormal basis. Sort of last bit. I actually maintain it for physics. I mean, the physical analog of an orthonormal basis is really a freely formed frame. I mean, a 1 foot ruler is 1 foot in an orthonormal basis. Up by 1 meter is a meter in an orthonormal basis. And to see the physics of tensors, I think it's really much better to work on an orthonormal basis. And it's obvious the coverage is going on the last, but you don't have to worry about your corner systems. You really see the physical nature of tensors on an orthonormal basis. And of course, so from this, remember, this is going to be 1/2 R1 to AB. mu b, so that's just the same thing as r1 plus mu 1 2. So the components of the Riemann tensor, there's only one in two dimensions. And all else, well, the radius of the sphere. So, of course, you can work out the components of the Ricci tensor. I'll use script R for the Ricci tensor. Right? This is not a form, because it's going to be symmetric in the Q system. I just raise the first index and the Riemann tensor. So, and the two-bit matrix, of course, that's just one of the last ones. Of course, delta AB is the best can offer on the basis. So the Ricci scalar, it's two of the last ones. Very simple example. In the last 20 minutes, I can try and tackle a slightly more complicated example, which I hope to mention, but really as an efficient way of calculating the process. Let's take a four-dimensional example, and this time I'll complicate the issue by introducing a time like. So if a value is some function of a bar alone, so this is obviously the sort of style metric, but I'll just work it out for the general. E naught, take the square root of f and pt, E1, the square root of f and dr, E2, I can take the root of theta, and the square root of r. So for the diagonal matrix, of course, it's really trivial to read off a bunch of orthogonal forms. It's a bit more involved if the matrix is not diagonal. If you start off in a coordinate system, the matrix is not diagonal. But for diagonal matrix, it's really easy.
So in that case, is it better to try to go to a diagonal?
If you can't go to the diagonal basis, it's often the best thing to do. Yeah. But you know, if you're working with a Kerr metric and the implications, then it's really hard to interpret the metric in terms of coordinates, it can be very endless as a diagonal metric. So, in a coordinate system, which is diagonal, it's not easy. So, we worked out the derivatives. F is a function by, I'm assuming, F is a function only of R. So I think F is your derivative, I just differentiate the coefficient function here. So we're half F prime over the F and get the R like G. Here V1, I don't even need to think about it. F is a function only of R. So it's a closed form. So we just have V1 is always here. PE2, R is no longer a constant as it was for the. For example, of the next two, so DE2 is this. DE3 the two components, it's the only one that belongs to.
DE1 is 0 because the width R, the R is
2. Yeah, it's if you take D. Of any function, any function f, yeah, is always zero. Because you differentiate f and then the PR by SDR.
Yes, that might not be necessary. People would know that the wedge packet being.
Right, yeah, so it's this is derivative of f. And PR by SDR, but because the wedge problem is not symmetric, so. So I can rewrite this as because of the 1 over f here, 1 over f here, and a root over f here, dr by dt is the same thing as e1 by g0. So this is minus. We can e0 1. I swap the t and I write the root of this one. This is 1 over r e1 2 because d theta is just e2 over r. This is this is root f over r. I want to play it off on a basis. This so dr is root f e1, and sine theta d phi is 1 over r dt. So this first term here is the square root of f over r e1 t, and the second term, we've already seen that in the example of the sphere. It's called theta over r dt. It's never used as a formula here to calculate the connection. And it's four dimensions, these things are symmetric, and with four values of A and four values of B, so it's six things. Whereas in using coordinates, it would be. We look through our four, so C here takes on four values. This is only going to be non-zero if we have a DE, which is both an E0 and an E1, otherwise it vanishes. And only one of them is both an E0 and an E1. So only C is equal to zero contributes. So we'll put C is equal to zero in here, the other. I naught, I1 contracted with DE1 is 0, DE2 is 0, and DE3 is 0. Only C equals 0 contributes. We should be careful about the position here. I've got a C downstairs, but C is 0. So if I raise it off, then it changes sign. So only C equals 0 contributes here, and I'll raise this C up, but I'll be careful. This is 0, because dE1 is 0. And again, I'll raise this 0 up and change the sign. And for the same reason as before with the sphere, these actually get me the same. These just reinforce. Minus I1 dE0, dE0, I1. If we can track I1, print it out explicitly. If we can track that 2 form with I1, I have to pull 1 through 0. So I get a minus 1. It's minus 1.
So I can track this with I1, I get minus E naught, which combines that minus together plus. There's an overall minus sign here, these actually reinforce. We get minus. Oh, with this half. I get a half from here, a half from here, and these combined become one. So that's all I have one. Omega naught 2. We need a two form here that contains both a 0 and a 2, but none of them does. DE2 is non zero, but it doesn't contain an E naught. So this is zero. DE naught is non zero, but it doesn't contain an E2. A little bit of thought. So you can make yourself exactly the same as true. Three. Omega 1, 2. Well, again, for the first term here, we need the exterior derivative of the orthonormal 1 form, which contains both a 1 and a 2. There's only one. So C's got to be equal to 2. So now I don't care whether it's off tails or on scales, it's a space like index. So I want to contract this with I1, I2, and again, if you hit this with I2, you have to fill it through the E1, you get a minus sign, so you get a minus E1. So I'll end up with a half on the side. We'll get minus E2 times this thing. Contracted minus E2 over R. And you contract this with I1, I2, you get minus 1 over R. This is zero. So the next term, I1 DE2, the last one is 0 because it's actually DE1 and DE1 branches. So we're going to apply this one. We get minus I1 DE2. For I1 of DE2, you just strike off that one. DQ plus. Oh, I apologize. I apologize. I'm a mistake. Actually, we get it. Sorry. So I should carry on. Omega 1, 3, again, a little bit half, so you can get pretty quick at this. That's the only one that's going to contribute. The calculation is almost identical. It's identical to the Omega 1, 2, because we have the same way, except you're going to be here. And so we've now got 5 of them, there's only one more to calculate. The only thing we're going to do is that. And it's exactly the same as for the sphere.
So I can summarize. Minus F times true root F E naught. And for calculating the Riemann tensor, we need to take an extra derivative of this, so it's convenient to re express the E naught as root F dt. Omega of 2 and omega of B both vanish. Omega 1, 2 vanish from F 2. That's just vanish from F theta. Omega 1, V. That's the connection. So obviously the C can't be a zero because it's not symmetric, it can't be a one. So C here has to be either two or three, but omega dot two and omega dot three both vanish. So this is just T and omega dot one. And omega dot one I've got it up there. So here, omega dot 2 vanishes. Again, the C can't be equal to 0 because it's not symmetric, it can't be equal to 2. So C here is either 1 or 3. Omega dot 3 vanishes, so this has got to be omega dot 1. Omega dot 2, it's the only thing we choose. One of the set form, but not one cancels the reject from that position. On the R of T is the same. Quickest way of getting directly a little hole to go on 2 is just keep this. Which is differentiating with F. Again, C here has to be either 0 or 3, whereas it's going to vanish. But it's 0 omega 2 vanishes, so the only thing we have here is omega 1, 3, squared shared omega 3 2, omega 1 3 is proportional to E 3, omega 2 3 is proportional to E 3. So we have to follow this. So this is minus 2. So I'll just write down the last two rules. Giving you sufficient detail, make it obvious on the point of work. R1 equals exactly the same way as R12. That's essentially the same for symmetry. If any or two are in the three, and then lastly, this works out as you only find the C that you can use, the C is equal to 1. And this is P on the 2C, that's exactly the same as for the sphere. Double the last term, E2V in this term, and the other term, 2-1 by 1-3. You have to swap these two down to the minus sign. Root F and reinforce. And 1 minus F. So now we need to read off the intercept. Here, 1 more. Just a half vector double prime. 1 more, 2 more, 2. So there's nothing else, a whole lot more information. It's a pretty efficient way of calculating, at least for a general metric, it's not very messy, of course. And this is particularly simple because of the symmetry, and it's easy to write the metric diagonally. But if you did this using the usual coordinates, things like calculus, there's a lot more stuff to calculate. It would take a lot more. Okay. The seminar for the question, isn't it?
I was hoping you would mention that for the larger picture. I think, isn't it that we can say that basically everything is a differential form? If we look at an arbitrary tensor, and it may have, let's say, p indices, r of which may be anti-symmetric, then we call it an R form, which has some other indices as well. So it's a P minus R tensor-valued R form, right? So it's basically everything can be viewed as a form. And even if it has no anti-symmetric indices whatsoever, we can still just pick one of them and say it's a one form with respect to that, or even none of them and say it's a zero form with respect to that. If we do that, then everything becomes a form. In fact, even the Christoffel symbols, connections, and so on can be viewed as walk forms. They're just tensor-valued forms. They may be the algebra-valued forms. So in any case, everything's a form. And then that's nice, because we know that forms have particular transformation properties, particular differentiation, integration properties. Especially the differentiation properties are so nice. But now they are not really forms in the usual sense, because they have those extra indices. So we have to worry about the differential properties. And what we want is that still the Leibniz rule holds. One way or another, the Leibniz rule may hold, perhaps with a sign. Okay? And that is how we arrive at the exterior derivative, at the inner derivative, at, you know, the core derivative, and the inner derivative. They all obey Leibniz rules from P forms to P forms, or to P plus 1, P minus 1, and so on. And that's also very useful, because then we can do calculations without having to remember how exactly we define derivatives, because we can just use the product rule, I mean, the Leibniz rule to evaluate them. And implicitly, I think you've done that.
Several
places there. I just wanted to mention this as the, you know, the wider picture, because it might help.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you say. Basically, if you have something which is the antithesis of the differential form, I suppose you have some tensor, which is Q and is upstairs, it's completely symmetric.
So it's still a zero
exactly
form.
It's
still a zero form.
You can turn this into an orthonormal basis, and then using this V, you can then differentiate it. So. Something like the sum from I is 1 to Q of omega AI B W. Covariant text theory derivative of a symmetric tensor. And that's what you're. So in that sense, every tensor in terms of forms.
Yeah, and the differentiations are, the definitions for the derivatives are determined if we just insist on this being some linear map that maps from P forms to P plus 1 or P or P minus 1 forms with a Leibniz rule, perhaps with a minus sign. And then all those formulas pop out.
But that's, as I tried to emphasize, what people call the spin connection is really exactly the same as the ordinary connections. So once you've introduced this connection omega, you can do absolutely anything you can do with the usual connection, because it's the same object in different cases.
You didn't write down the action equation.
No, I was hoping to get to that, but I don't have time. I need to define the residual for the action. I need that. Sorry?
I need
that.
But the thing is, actually, in the fall, we teach a course on differential geometry and general relativity. Basically, this, but 20 hours of it.
I only had two. I aim to do it.
Thank you very much.